broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This month, the speaker is Jim Morris. Morris is the president of Indiana Pacers Sports and Entertainment. He talks about the upcoming basketball season and his experiences in other walks of life, including the United Nations World Food Program.
Jim Morris is not only an accomplished business leader, but also a great humanitarian and a real asset to the state of Indiana. For over 35 years, Morris has combined a distinguished career in business, philanthropic, and humanitarian leadership with a personal life in public service. Before his current role as president of Pacers Sports and Entertainment, Morris was the executive director of the United Nations World Food Program, where he oversaw the world's largest food aid organization. In 2003, Morris successfully guided the program in carrying out the largest humanitarian operation in history, feeding 27 million Iraqis for over a year. Morris has said, "Hunger is the greatest weapon of mass destruction in the world." After 5 years with the World Food Program, Morris returned to Indianapolis last year and he became president of the Pacers. Before his time with the United Nations, Morris has held many prominent positions in Indiana. He served as chief of staff for then Indianapolis Mayor Richard Lugar. He then moved on to the Lilly Endowment, where he was president for 6 years, and he later became chairman and chief executive of IWC Resources Corporation, the Indianapolis Water Company. He's a native of Terre Haute, also a founding director of the Indiana Sports Corp. Morris volunteer positions have really too numerous to list, but include the United States Olympic Committee, the American Red Cross, and the Board of Trustees for Indiana University. Also, he was on the Board of Trustees for Indiana State as well, and actually, spending some time with him today, he knows a lot about Evansville, too, so I've learned a lot about Evansville from him today. Following his time with the World Food Program, and he just said this a minute ago, Morris said, "I reached a point in my life when I realized that nothing I would do going forward would be as important as what I just did." I've had the opportunity to hear Jim speak many times and be around him. He's definitely a wise man and a real asset to our state and our country. So please welcome Jim Morris.
Thank you very much, Steve. Being president of the Indiana Pacers is just as difficult as leading the United Nations World Food Program, just not as important. And so we'll get that. A few weeks ago, I had a conference call that came from my friend Bob Jones and my friend Neil Ellerbrook. And they called and they said, "Jim, you are a patriotic American and that you believe in free speech." I said, "Yes." I said, "We'd like for you to come to Evansville and give one." So here I am, reminded of what Elizabeth Taylor said to each of her seven husbands. "It's okay, honey, I won't keep you long." You have to see if the first joke gets a response before you have the courage to try that one. I am happy to be in Evansville for a lot of reasons. I admire this community. Really quite an extraordinary place. I'm also eager for those of us that are Hoosiers in this extraordinary state we live in to be more of one community. I, as a Hoosier, want great things for Evansville. I want great things for Gary. I want great things for my hometown of Terre Haute. I want great things for the city where I live now. And we're all in this together. And I think we all need to work just a little harder at being advocates and being there for each other. And, you know, coming out of the recent session of the Indiana General Assembly, on occasion I hear somebody taking a shot at this or that, and It's not productive, you know. Being positive, leadership is about being upbeat and positive and focused on the future and finding a way to uplift and encourage and inspire those around you. And I think as Hoosiers, it's a remarkable place that we live, and we have to work a little harder at that. And we're small enough for us to achieve our aspirations, to achieve greatness. We sort of have to give each other the benefit of the doubt. I trust the leadership of Evansville that it wants, that has good thoughts about this community's future. Therefore, I'm willing to say, hey, let's go to work and get it done. And I feel that way about all of Indiana's 92 counties. And I think it's important that we just think a little bit about that. Evansville has given so much to the state of Indiana. The experience of Southern Indiana Higher Education over the years in creating the University of Southern Indiana is as powerful an example of public-private partnership, of civic leadership, of the business community working with the civic community and the labor community and the political community to cause something extraordinary to happen that I have ever seen in the state of Indiana. And the group that led that effort years ago, they were not going to be stopped. Yet they put their resources and their money where their ideas and where their mouth was. And they acquired the land, and slowly but surely they went about the business of building a very substantial public university to serve this community. And they did it in a community that already had a very fine private university. The University of Evansville is admired all over the world for lots of things. Students come from all over the world to study there. But the commitment it has made to global and international education is remarkable. I'm chairman of the board of Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis. It's associated with the medical school. This year, 200,000 patients from every county in the state of Indiana, children, will come to Riley Hospital. The idea of Riley Hospital was conceived in Evansville, Indiana. There was a Rotary Convention here in 1921 when Rotarians from 40 or 50 clubs were looking for a way to honor the Hoosier poet James Whitcomb Riley. And they said, wouldn't it be a great thing if we built an extraordinary hospital for children in our state so that every child could have superb health care without ever any concern for money? And that idea came from your hometown. Now, you should be proud of that. It was a great gift to the state of Indiana. I worked very hard when I was with the World Food Program, building relationships with religious leaders around the world. And on one occasion, I went to Lambeth Palace in London to visit with the Archbishop of Canterbury, newly elected, and he had lots of challenges on his plate. But as I arrived there, there was a young man dressed in cleric garb who came quickly up to greet me. And he said, "Oh, Mr. Morris," he said, "I've wanted to meet you for so long." I, to be truthful, couldn't imagine why. And he said, "I'm from Evansville, Indiana." And the pastor that is the right hand of the Archbishop of Canterbury is from your hometown. I thought it was strange that there was an American young man that was doing this for the head of the Church of England. But and he said, "By the way, my granddad went to Wabash College." And there was not a day that I had this job for 5 years traveling all over the world that I didn't come in contact with somebody that had a strong tie to the state of Indiana. And oftentimes it was based on universities. When I was at Lilly Endowment, I developed a special interest in New Harmony. Mr. Lilly was a great fan and had an intense interest in Indiana history, and he was very consumed with the history of New Harmony, the fact that the Owen brothers sort of started the Smithsonian Institute. They intellectualized it. They put the legislation in place, and then the other Owen brother figured out what the Smithsonian ought to look like, and that came from southwestern Indiana. And I was always grateful that the University of Southern Indiana had a strong partnership with New Harmony. So remarkable things about your community. I was here, heaven forbid, just a few weeks ago to speak at the mayor's invitation and Neil Ellerbrook's invitation to speak to business leaders and to speak to the Rotary Club. And in the back of my mind, I had agreed to come speak to the Economic Club, but I wasn't really sure when. I knew that I said it a long time ago, and then finally somebody said, "Hey, you're coming down here." I said, "Well, hell, I was just there." heck, I was just there. But the good news is that today is Tuesday, right? And Rotary meets on Tuesday, so all the folks that I talked to on that Tuesday aren't here today. So my humor, I can use the same stories. I came on that occasion to, at the invitation of the mayor and the invitation of some business leaders, to talk about this community's dream of a new civic facility, an arena, a theater, a public gathering space, and to say what that mentality of building an extraordinary, you know, life is about a search for community. We come together in physical space. This is where we're together for our meetings, our meals. And physical space is really important in terms of building a sense of community. And cities like Indianapolis or Evansville or Fort Wayne, we have no chance if we don't have some sense of unity, some sense of community, that if we don't work hard at being inclusive, at reaching out and seeing that everybody is a part of the discussion and the opportunity. Indianapolis, if it has done anything right, it has been the decision to build all of its physical civic assets downtown. There were people who wanted to build the zoo out on the perimeter of the city around the interstate, who wanted to build the convention center, the baseball stadium, the football stadium, Conseco Fieldhouse, museums. But the leadership of our town said, no, if we're going to do those things, they have to be built right downtown. Right downtown so that everybody who is a part of the Central Indiana community has access to them. If you're from Carmel or Greenfield or Greenwood or Plainfield or Center Township, you have access to these extraordinary physical facilities. We have, you know, the downtown, and I suspect it is or should be the same here. Indianapolis is a city of 500-600 neighborhoods. I don't know how many neighborhoods there are in greater Evansville, but the downtown is the one neighborhood that belongs to everyone. And you just can't overstate that, the importance of doing things like this centrally located. So in our community, we built these assets right downtown, and suddenly the place was transformed. And you have a remarkable aggregation of public facilities close by, and you have this new opportunity to build the new community facility. And by the way, I committed to the Pacers, or committed to the mayor, if we are invited, the Pacers will come play the first game there. Now, the University of Southern Indiana and the University of Evansville, and I don't know who else may not like that, but we'll play a triple header. We'll all play the same day. But the notion of the vitality of a city, the reputation of a city, when I come to downtown, when I come to Evansville, I come downtown. And when I wander about and I see a lively, vital, active, engaged community, I leave the community thinking, boy, that's a heck of a place. There's a lot going on there. And the sum is greater than the parts. The Conseco Fieldhouse, where I hang out now, brings 2 million people a year to downtown Indianapolis. It directly affects 3,000 jobs. It brings $300 million to the economy. And it has the ability to do high school graduations, to do Elton John and Billy Joel, to do the Big Ten tournament, to do the IHSAA tournament, to do the Indiana Fever, by the way, our women's team sponsored by Old National Bank, which has now won 9 in a row, heaven forbid. The Pacers, it all, you know, 500 events in one building during the course of the year. The economic impact, the reputational value, the enhancement of the vitality and the liveliness. You know, cities compete. Evansville competes with cities all across this country, and in fact, all around the world. You compete for investment capital. You compete for jobs. You compete for bright young people. The University of Evansville or Ivy Tech or the University of Southern Indiana, they want the very brightest students going there, and they want the best people teaching there. Old National Bank or Integra or whoever, the bank, you want the best young bankers to come here. Well, why will they come? They'll come because lots of reasons, but being upbeat and lively and interesting is at the core. Indianapolis used to compete with Cincinnati and Louisville and Columbus, but today our competition is Tokyo and Singapore and Bangkok, the Indiana University School of Medicine competing for the best medical talent in the world. Those folks can go anywhere. It's really important that we have a place to play basketball where Yao Ming will come twice a year. Eli Lilly and Company, three blocks south of Conseco Fieldhouse, has 600 Chinese PhD research scientists working there. I mean, who would have ever thought that something like that? I mean, it's mind-boggling. But the fact of the matter is we have to work hard at making our communities attractive so that we can win the competition. And you have an enormous opportunity. You have so much going for you with the strength of higher education here, with the quality of life, the cultural life. I noticed that your Philharmonic will celebrate its 75th anniversary this year. These are reasons why people want to come, and the reasons people will want to invest here. So the sports strategy for Indianapolis is, you know, and it's a dangerous thing to leave Indianapolis and go elsewhere in the state and talk about Indianapolis' strategy. So I apologize in advance. I won't linger on it long. But one of our strategies was to become an important center of sports and fitness and athletics. We were the headquarters of the AAU. They were breaking up. And the opportunity was either to lose it all or to make the most of it. We said, well, this along with health and agriculture and culture. These are our opportunities to be something a little special. And this week, this month in Indianapolis, we'll have the Brickyard 400. We'll have the PGA U.S. Senior Golf Championship. We had the National Swimming Championships last week. We'll have the National Tennis Championships with Andy Roddick in a few days. We had 11,000 junior bowlers in town this week. The economic impact of this is extraordinary. In the middle of all this, the NCAA says we'll move to Indianapolis. And they say, well, that's a good thing. And by the way, once we get there, we're going to have 75% of our conventions there. And we're going to have the Final Four for men and women there every 5 years. And the Big Ten says, gee, that's a good thing. So we'll bring the Big Ten tournament for men and women basketball to Indianapolis every year. Suddenly you have a whole different reputation, a different image, a different profile. And this industry in our town employs 66,000 people. Hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes generated for the state of Indiana. And it's the return on investment has been something beyond anything most American Fortune 1000 companies could ever have expected. And you have the same opportunity. The NCAA would like to bring many more events to Evansville. Many of you are quite young, but you can remember those extraordinary University of Evansville basketball teams that filled Roberts Arena, and you had national championships and regional games here. What an extraordinary thing for your city and for this part of the state of Indiana. And you have an opportunity to do something really quite extraordinary in your own way going forward. So I'm a huge advocate. I admire your leadership for being focused on this piece of the agenda. And by the way, it's up to folks like you and folks who were in the Rotary Club where I spoke a few weeks ago to see that the partisanship and, on occasion it can get pretty mean, but that's downplayed. The fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, you think about the future of Evansville, or we think about the future of the state of Indiana. There aren't many Republican or Democrat differing views on that. We all want the economy to grow. We want good education for our kids. We want the world to know about us. We want investment to come. We want the quality of life to be better every day. There's a heck of a, Mother Teresa, I usually end my comments with this, but Mother Teresa said, if we don't have peace in the world, it's because we forgot we belong to each other. And, we do belong to each other, and together, we're a heck of a lot stronger than we are apart. You truly never know what is around the corner. I would have never expected that I would have had an opportunity to lead the United Nations World Food Program. I had had a career in government and philanthropy and business, was headed to retirement, I guess, probably would have done something like John is doing with the really important food bank in the community or the Boy Scouts or the Red Cross, things that I cared about. But suddenly I had this opportunity to move to Rome and lead the United Nations World Food Program. I always had hoped that maybe I was a good-hearted, decent guy that cared about people who were vulnerable and at risk. But I have to say I didn't know a lot about the depth of difficulty and sadness and vulnerability of so many people around the world. There are 2 billion people in the world that live on less than $2 a day. There are 960 million, at least 100 million more than a year ago, that are malnourished today, that are hungry. Far too many people in the world will never have a magnificent luncheon like we had today, or a good breakfast or a good dinner. So I had this opportunity to join the United Nations World Food Program, headquartered in Rome, not for any good reason, but when the UN was formed, they sent the Atomic Energy Agency to Vienna. They sent World Health to Geneva, and they sent the food agencies to Rome. I suppose you could laugh a little bit and figure out why they did that, but it wasn't a bad gig for 5 years, although I did travel full-time. And the fact of the matter is that 960 million people, half of them children, are malnourished. 25,000 people die every day of hunger, 18,000 of them children. Think of what the outrage would be if in the paper tomorrow morning the headline said, yesterday 45 747 airplanes crashed, everybody on board was killed, and oh, by the way, they were all children. And oh, by the way, it's going to happen every day for the foreseeable future. We wouldn't accept that. But the fact of the matter is that is the predicament that affects so much of the world. Most of the hungry folks are in Asia. The good news is that India and China now have, I think, the political will and the focus and the wherewithal to address hunger in their own countries. Still huge numbers of people in places like Cambodia and Laos and Bangladesh are at risk. The greatest predicament, of course, is in Africa. A third of the people that live in Africa are malnourished. Huge, like all of the tough issues of the day, they always fall disproportionately on the backs of women and children. 85% of the agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa is conducted by women. Young women have well over a half of the HIV infections in that part of the world. Extraordinary difficulty. And at the end of the day, you know, most of the great economies of the world were based on the development of a substantial agricultural economy. Ours is the prime example. And for all sorts of reasons, easily identified, but many totally unacceptable, the hunger issue, the poverty issue, the extraordinary impact on children of the lack of good nutrition in sub-Saharan Africa, remarkable. I was the Secretary General's special envoy for Malawi and Mozambique, Lesotho, Swaziland, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Namibia for 5 years. A place where there are maybe 20 million children orphaned. Think of this, a country like Zimbabwe, that at one time provided so much of Africa and the rest of the world's commodities. Today, 12 million people living there, 1,300,000 children orphaned. Life expectancy has gone from 68 to 35. HIV positive, 25% of the population. And at the end of the day, hunger and nutrition makes all the difference in the world in trying to come out of these kinds of issues. Now, it requires integrity and it requires political leadership with vision and commitment and will. And too many places in Africa don't have that. And it's sad when you think of the ultimate impact of dishonest and inadequate leadership. I am overwhelmed with, every day I was in the job, I was proud to be an American. When Eisenhower started the Food for Peace program in the 50s, when he said the world will be changed with wheat, not weapons, since his initiative, I suspect maybe 6 billion people around the world have been fed by Americans. The impact of the land-grant college system in our country on agricultural research and productivity and extension systems around the world is remarkable. As Hoosiers, we should be very proud of Purdue University. 2 out of the last 3 years, members of the faculty of the Purdue School of Agriculture have been awarded the World Food Prize. Dr. Phil Nelson, distinguished professor at Purdue, did brilliant work in figuring out how to preserve food, how to store food, and now a brilliant Ethiopian professor at Purdue has changed the impact of sorghum. Sorghum's one of the five most important commodities feeding people in Africa. This brilliant professor from Purdue figured out how to make it more drought resistant, how to increase the yield in dramatic ways, how to make it more weed resistant. Impact of Hoosiers around the world addressing the hunger issue has been enormous. Dick Lugar, my pal, has been leading the way with Senator Casey of Pennsylvania to rethink how, you know, the very historic meeting in Rome this week where the G8 put food security and hunger at the top of their agenda. And the G8 nations said, we're going to commit $20 billion over the next 3 years to food security and hunger around the world. And they said, by the way, we're going to focus more on food production and agricultural technology and building infrastructure and seeds and fertilizer and water, in addition to seeing that people are fed to save their lives today. A historic commitment. Now, these big international meetings are always good at making major pronouncements and major commitments, and the proof will be in reality over time to see actually what is produced. But Dick Lugar has led the way to cause food security to continue to be a keystone of American foreign policy and to make more investments in partnerships between American universities and research institutions with their counterparts around the world. The World Bank would tell you that the most powerful investment any community, any country can make is in being certain that children are born to healthy mothers and they're well-nourished the first 2 years of life. The World Health Organization would tell you that the single most critical health issue in the world is good nutrition. The folks that run UNAIDS would tell you that in terms of the fight against HIV around the world, which is more devastating than we can comprehend, actually, its impact on every facet of society. But they would tell you that addressing the hunger, you know, all the antiretroviral therapy in the world, if the body is poorly nourished and clean water is not available, it won't work. And so the impact of these issues is enormous. Someone asked me what my profound memory is of my experience. On the one hand, I have wonderful feelings about the fact that we were able to feed 2.5 million people in the tsunami, 1 million people in the Pakistani earthquake, a huge logistical undertaking, feeding 27 million people, the entire population of Iraq, for a year and a half. But my haunting memory of the experience is the fact that there's still 450, 500 million hungry kids in the world. And, you know, it's not as it should be. You know, the life of a child, whether it's in Malawi or Evansville, my faith tells me that the life of that child is equally precious wherever it is. And my haunting feeling of ineffectiveness or insufficiency or not getting the job done is the fact that there are just so many children in the world that continue to struggle every day. And it is something that we can do something about. You feed the little girl in Malawi, and you know, maybe 2,000 calories a day. You feed the little girl, and everything about her life changes for the better. She has no chance to go to school if she's hungry. But even if she goes to school for 5 years and is well fed, 50% less likely to give birth to a low birth weight baby, 50% less likely to be HIV positive. She'll have children when she's 20, not when she's 12. She'll have 2 or 3, not 8 or 10. All of the aspirations of her life change for the better. And my own strongly held view is that the world needs to have a compelling focus on the issue of child hunger. It is, you know, my friend Obasanjo, the president of Nigeria, used to say, Jim, you know, what would you do if your children were hungry? And he would say, you know, a hungry man is an angry man. People would debate ad nauseum why it's important for the world to come together and address these issues. Well, for me, you know, some would say, well, it's an economic issue. It has an enormous impact on gross national product if people are hungry. Others would say, well, it has a huge impact on terrorism and national security. But for me, you know, it truly is just a moral issue, the moral imperative that in this world, no one should starve, especially women and children. You know, if there are universal principles among all of our faiths, if you're a Christian, you know, you say, I was hungry and you fed me, as you do it to the least of these, you do it unto me. The Jewish scriptures say, God has given us an abundance of food. And the greatest commandment of all is to see that it's shared widely. The Prophet Muhammad said, you can't go to sleep tonight on a full stomach if your brother or sister is trying to go to sleep across the way on an empty stomach. Gandhi said, you know, to a hungry man, God will appear as a piece of food. So these universal notions of how do we come together as a community to see, and we do it through John's agency in the tri-state area. And by the way, 1 out of 10 Hoosiers is food insecure sometime during the course of the year. And when economic times are difficult, more people are at risk. And once again, it always hits kids the worst. But how do we come together to find ways to say this is not acceptable, that those of us who have some responsibility to reach out and put our arms around those who need a boost, that we have a responsibility to be generous. You know, back to my Indianapolis analogy, why have extraordinary things happened there? We had 120 companies who contributed 2 to 5% of pre-tax profits for charitable, civic, educational, public good kinds of things. They partnered with government. They partnered with civic activities. Everybody came together, was generous, just did a little more, and the payoff was absolutely enormous. The opportunity to see that people aren't hungry, to see that kids especially, once again, the precious value of the life of a child, and generosity makes all the difference in the world. So it was a remarkable experience. I had 9 meetings with Robert Gabriel Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe. Nothing in my life other than my time as a trustee of Indiana University dealing with Bob Knight prepared me to deal with Mugabe. I spent a lot of time in North Korea. North Korea, you know, we were feeding a third of the population. Remarkable. The average North Korean 7-year-old boy is already 8 inches shorter and 20 pounds lighter than his South Korean counterpart. It's mind-boggling. But the generosity of our country in terms of providing food, I'm a sort of a middle-of-the-road Republican, maybe one of 21, 22 left in the world, but I always wondered what kind of a man George McGovern was. But I got to know him pretty well. And George McGovern and Bob Dole, the left and the right, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, they came together to say that the world should have the same opportunity for a school feeding program that kids in the United States have. They said, our differences are sort of artificial here. We've got to find a way to come together and do something very, very significant and remarkable work. So my pleasure to be with you to cause you to think about your own generosity, to think about the opportunity you have to live in this extraordinary community. And, you know, I have a good friend, Bob Payton, who talks about generational serial reciprocity, that each generation benefits from what went before. And each generation has the responsibility to see that it's better for those who will follow. And by the way, you never feel so good about yourself as when you're doing something for someone else. And there is no better feeling in the world, I think, than being a part of a community enterprise coming together in an absolutely unselfish way for the common good. And by the way, in the long run, everybody just benefits in enormous ways. And that's the opportunity you have in this community, but that's the opportunity we have as Americans to help address this issue of hunger and poverty around the world with an intense focus on the well-being of children. It's in all of our best interests, but it also has the added advantage of being the right thing to do. So thank you. Be happy to take a question or two if you have them about life in the NBA, life in the WNBA, life in the state of Indiana, the World Food Program, or...
How about a round of applause for us? We do have about 10 minutes or so for questions, and I got a couple up here, and I'm going to ask my favorite one first, Jim, and if you could give us a little preview of what we ought to look for from the Pacers this season.
Well, Larry Bird runs our basketball operation. Larry Bird is as intense and as competitive, great player, great coach, and I believe is a will be a great basketball general manager leader. The theory is to assemble a core of really remarkable players and then build on that. Danny Granger was an all-star last year, and he was named, interesting, twice in his career, the most improved player in the NBA. Engineer, graduate engineer, University of New Mexico. Our two draft choices last year, Roy Hibbert, 7'3", graduate of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., Brandon Rush, very close to his degree from the University of Kansas, played on the national championship team. Troy Murphy, Notre Dame guy. Mike Dunleavy, Duke guy. Mike Dunleavy hurt last year for 80% of the season, is really working hard to get back in shape. Two draft choices, Tyler Hansbrough from the University of North Carolina. Led the ACC 4 years in scoring, and I believe he graduated with the all-time records both in scoring and in rebounding. We had the Summer League five games in Orlando last week. We won all five. Now, these are your very young players playing. I asked Larry Bird, I said, Larry, does this guy play as hard as you do? He said, Jim, he plays harder. He said, I have never in my life seen a young basketball player with a motor like this guy. And his use of the word means, motor means just go, 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 go. And just, so the notion is that this man's work ethic is so remarkable, and he's such a hard-nosed player. From Missouri, his father's a physician. It's interesting, at UNC Chapel Hill, He wanted to have a challenge, and he learned to speak Swahili. And I was going to say why, but it's a good thing. And I mean, the smart kid, the number two draft choice, AJ Price, was the point guard for the University of Connecticut national championship team. So we picked up a guy named Deshante Jones this week, a hard-nosed player, a few years in the league from Denver. So our folks are very optimistic about the kind of basketball that you're going to see from the Indiana Pacers this year. The Fever are remarkable. Won 9 games in a row. The ladies, all college graduates. By the way, we don't have anybody on our team this year that you would not be pleased to have in your home for Sunday lunch. We ran into some difficulties with some behavioral issues. The behavioral problems are gone. We won't put up with any foolishness. Bird is as hard-nosed on that as anybody. But these ladies, Tamika Catchings, two-time Olympian, We have likely four members of our team on the All-Star team from the East. Our coach, Len Dunn, will coach the Eastern All-Stars. So last year our attendance was up a couple of thousand per game. We used to sell out the place every night. And it's our objective to sell it out again and to win a championship. And we're very focused on getting that done. Fair enough?
Sounds like we're going to have a good season.
Please come. if you don't want to pay, just call me and I'll give you a ticket, but I'd prefer you pay. It is a business. It's an important business. The World Food Program had fed tens of millions of people in China. And we were getting to a point where China really had the foreign exchange and had the capacity and the focus to, they didn't need us at all. And so I was working hard to convert China from being a recipient to being a donor. And my last December in office, the foreign minister, Mr. Lee, L.I., small man, had been their ambassador to Washington and the U.N. in New York, invited me to his home for lunch, Christmas week. Remarkable experience. But we come to lunch in a table about like this, and Foreign Minister Lee is on my right. The agricultural minister is on my right. The foreign minister is on my left. The agricultural minister on my right. And I was prepared for a conversation about commodity prices and transportation and humanitarian issues around the world. And the foreign minister said, "Now, Jim," he said, "you're from Indiana." He said, "Tell me about Reggie Miller." And I thought, now I could answer that question. But I thought, of all the things this man, and we had developed a casual acquaintance, and I liked him. He was very amiable. I thought, this is of all the things this man could have asked me. But his face on my hometown, our state, was Reggie Miller. And there are two basketball games televised every day from the U.S. back to China. And, of course, Yao Ming and then the fellow that plays it in Milwaukee, a big reason for that. But it was a good thing to talk about. So, anyway.
Could you give us just 2 minutes on all the controversy about the state budget and the issues with the revenue and then how that impacts a professional sports franchise in our state?
Sure. You know we've been through a General Assembly in about as difficult an economic predicament as conditions that we've had for a long, long time. They finally passed a budget with bipartisan support, but still with probably some dissenting folks. Probably didn't get everything that everyone wanted for education. The debate, certainly K through 12, focused on the governor's interest that state funds be allocated on a per capita basis. As student enrollment increases, the school district would get more. And then the other notion that urban school districts that have generally declining school population and have very expensive fixed plants in place. Many of them probably got less than they would have hoped. But at the end of the day, with the stimulus money, story in the Indianapolis paper this morning, they had a few weeks ago had laid off, 300 teachers. And this morning they announced that nearly all of them, of the 300, would be hired back. Not all, but within 10 or 20. Some would take early retirement and the others would with the combination. So I assume that the same would be true for the other urban districts around the state. Huge debate at the end of the day on the funding of the Capital Improvements Board in Marion County. The Capital Improvements Board is the public agency that operates the baseball stadium, the football stadium, owns Conseco Fieldhouse, but we operate, the Pacers operate it, and the convention center. And the convention center is, the football stadium, its first year in the new building, three times as big as the old building, is a more expensive proposition. I think no one knew how much it would cost to operate it. It's very tough in the NBA to operate in a small market. And we've lost $150 million over the last 10 years. And essentially, it's the cost of operating the building. In a small market, our payroll for the Pacers is the same as the Lakers or the Celtics or the Chicago Bulls. And there is virtually no revenue sharing in the NBA. In the NFL, 75% of the revenues are shared. So trying to figure out how you match up those who benefit from these facilities with those who pay for them. And it's a very tough predicament. So the legislature debated that issue. In some respects, maybe it's on occasion you see the legislature sitting as a gigantic city council for our cities. They're debating what kind of taxes we can have, what the form is of our government structures, et cetera. And at the end of the day, the governor said that I believe you can cut this much expense out of the Capital Improvements Board. And I know I was the governor's campaign chairman this past 4 years. I know him very well, and he believes that. The state gave permission to increase by 1% the innkeeper's tax for hotels. And then we have something called the Professional Sports Development Authority, where all of the tax revenues from Conseco Fieldhouse, from Lucas Oil Stadium, the Convention Center, all come into this entity pay the debt service on the building. We collect $8.5 million of taxes a year at Conseco Fieldhouse. We pay the debt service. We pay for the building. And so there was an effort to include some of the downtown hotels in that same district to generate some additional money. So the mayor would still say that there's not adequate money to operate the facilities. The governor would say there is adequate money to operate the facilities. And as the guy said, you know, some of my friends are against it and some of my friends are for it, and I'm simply for my friends. So we'll see how it works. It will work out. There's just too much at risk for it not to work out. But as I've looked at your plans to pay for this here with tax increment financing and food and beverage tax, and you're essentially going to pay for it with activities that are related. These are investments. You know, these are, in some respects, they're luxuries, but they're investments. They will make you attractive and competitive. And, if you sit idly by, the world will pass us all by. The world's going pretty fast. And so that's a... I'm reminded, we're getting late. I gave a speech the other day to a Rotary Club, and there was a man in the back of the room. He got up and started to walk out, and I said, "Sir, forgive me. I'm about done. Where are you going?" He said, "Well, I'm going to get a haircut." And I said, "Well, why didn't you get the haircut before I started speaking?" He said, I didn't need a haircut before you started speaking." I won't let you away without the last story. So sitting in the same table right here in front were a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, and they were older, and the man fell asleep, and he was snoring. And, you know, it was disconcerting. It was rude in some respects to the speaker and to the people in the audience. And I said, "Ma'am, I'm about done, but would you please be so kind to wake up your husband?" She said, "Sir, you wake him up, you put him to sleep. Thank you."
That was Jim Morris. He's the president of Indiana Pacers Sports and Entertainment. Morris has also served as the longtime executive director of the United Nations World Food Program. Cindy Hubert is the CEO of the organization Second Helpings. Its members help feed and train hungry people in Indianapolis. Hubert talks about why people are going hungry in the city, why there is food insecurity, and how this can be solved.
Second Helping started 11 years ago, and it really is our mission statement is to take perishable food and create meals to feed hungry people as well as empower folks to improve their lives. In 11 years, we've continued to do the same three things, our core mission. We are considered a community kitchen versus a food bank, which means that we rescue the food, and then we make meals out of that, as well as doing the culinary job training program. So that differentiates us from some of the food banks. We don't just have the food come in and give it out to individuals. We bring the food in and turn it into meals. When we started, we served one agency with 9 volunteers, 66 meals. That was 11 years ago. Today, we serve 68 agencies here in the city of Indianapolis. We serve about 580,000 meals every year. That equates to about 2,800 meals every day. And the third leg to our stool, if you will, is the Culinary Job Training Program. And this is for unemployed and underemployed adults. And they come to us for a 10-week program. It is free of charge to them. And this is to teach them culinary skills, but also to teach them life skills. Many of these folks will come to us from the missions and the shelters. They'll come to us as referrals from people that have graduated from our program. We work with Department of Corrections, all sorts of different avenues to get the students. The students come. They're here from 8 o'clock in the morning until 4:30 at least in the evening. They train out of one of the finest culinary books in the industry. But as I said, the most important part of their experience is their life skills, their soft skills, if you will. They're taught responsibility, accountability. They're taught anger management. They're taught financial literacy. We have many, many guest chefs that come in and help our culinary students. They come to us from Ivy Tech. They come, best chocolate in town, Elizabeth Garber, comes and teaches them truffle making. Jennifer Vigren, who's the former personnel director for the state of Indiana, comes and teaches them interviewing skills. We work with Dress for Success that dresses the women ready for going for their interviews. So we give them an awful lot other than how to cook and chop. And we're very proud. Our students, in 10 weeks, they graduate, first of all, it's all free. They don't have a penny of debt, but they're ready to go. Still, we're reporting 85 to 90% of them will be employed within 30 days of graduation. And at 180 days, we're still experiencing somewhere between 72 and 75% of them are still employed. Now, this is remarkable. First of all, it's a food services industry, which tends to be transient anyway. But more importantly, many of these folks have had barriers. They've had drug addiction. They've had incarceration. So not only are we getting them jobs and they're keeping jobs, but it's with kinds of barriers that they've had in their lives. We always smile and say the executive chef out at the Colts Complex is a graduate of Second Helpings, but there are very few hospitals, hotels, day nurseries here in our city that don't have a Second Helpings graduate in their kitchen. It's life-changing. The first day they come in, their shoulders are drooped, their heads are down. We all meet them the first day. We don't know their stories. The chef does, but we as staff and volunteers don't. And that's by design, so we don't judge. But by the time they get into there in their seventh week this week, they start to, they're squaring their shoulders. They're getting confidence. You know, I say they have options. They have confidence. So by the time they graduate, yes, they are very much different people.
Next month on the Economic Club of Indianapolis, the speaker is John Norquist. He's the president and CEO of the Congress for the New Urbanism. New urbanism is an alternative to sprawl and its accompanying environmental and social problems. Norquist will speak to the club Friday, August 28th in Fort Wayne. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us next month.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.